Dedication will be on case 74 in the Blue Rock Collection, Kingyu Osho and the Rice Pail. Ango's introduction. The Bakuyu sword in hand, he cuts through all complications. The clear mirror hung high, he himself utters the words of Vorochana. In self-mastery, he quietly puts on his clothes and takes his meal. In occult and playful samadhi, what would he do? See the following. Main subject. At every midday meal, Kingyu Osho would himself bring the pail of boiled rice and, in front of the refectory, dance and laugh loudly, saying, "Dear Bodhisattvas, come and take your meal." A monk said to Chokei, "The ancient worthy said, 'Dear Bodhisattvas, come and take your meal.' What does it mean?" Chokei said, "He seems to observe reflection and thanksgiving before the midday meal." Secho's verse. From among the white clouds, laughter rings out. He brings the rice himself to give to the monks. If golden-haired, they will follow him, even thousands of miles away. So, the koan is like this. Every day at midday, usually in traditional Buddhist settings, people really ate usually two meals a day, a breakfast and a big lunch. And then in the Chinese world, they added an unofficial dinner. So in traditional Buddhism, people eat a breakfast and they eat a midday meal at noon, and then there's not supposed to be any eating after that until next breakfast. So actually, if you go to Theravada temple, you'll notice that they observe this more or less strictly. It's like after the midday meal, that's it. China is cold, and people felt that maybe another meal was necessary to sustain people. So this is why we do sutras in the morning and sutras at lunch, but no sutras at dinner. It's an unofficial meal. It's not on the ledgers, so to speak. Yeah. It can be good sometimes. sometimes not so good. I admit. We eat an unofficial meal at night. In the midday meal, the big meal, at this temple, Kingyu Osho would be maybe the teacher, and Osho means like priest. Okay, so Kingyu monk or Kingyu priest would himself bring the pail of boiled rice and in front of the refectory dance and laugh loudly, saying, "Dear Bodhisattvas, come and take your meal." So it's like at this temple, every day people they go into the dining hall to eat, and traditionally they would take their bowls with them. Usually the bowls are left behind the person's seat. So all the people in the temple get up, pick up their bowls, and they walk out in file to the mats where they'll eat their lunch. And then they're waiting for lunch to be served. And every day at the midday meal, the teacher, Kingyu Osho, stands outside the dining hall, and he screams in through the window. He says, "Dear Bodhisattvas, come and take your meal." So he brings them the rice personally every day. It could get old, to hear this every day. You go to lunch, there's the teacher, he stands outside, he says, "Dear Bodhisattvas, come and take your rice." The first time it was nice, and every time, it doesn't say once, it says every day, So This kind of a curious koan, right? I mean, we'd all love to have a teacher like that, you know, somebody who would, you know, do amusing things, you know. If he does it every day, it could get to be old, you know. I'm told that the Soen Roshi, I never met Soen Roshi. My first teacher, Genki Roshi, was a student of Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, and Soen Roshi was Yamamoto Genpo's heir, Dharma heir, so to speak, at Ryutakuchi. One of my Dharma brothers did go to Ryutakuchi when Soen Roshi had Alzheimer's disease. It's interesting to be a deeply awakened person with Alzheimer's disease. My friends would go to see him, and some days he was quite lucid, you know. Some days not so lucid. So my friends, actually, Tom and Christina, went to see him, and they caught him in one of his less lucid moments. And he was painting or something, doing something, and they gave him a bottle of sake, and he started sprinkling sake on himself like cologne, right, and having a good time with the sake. So, you know, it was an interesting meal they had together. And another friend of mine went, and at that time, Soen was quite lucid, you know, so he was in and out. This is a human way, right, you know. Soen Roshi was quite a trickster, I'm told, quite a jokester, you know. So people would go into the Dokusan room, for example, and he would have a room very dark, and he would have a chair with his robes draped over it. And he'd be standing over it, looking, right? People would come in, and they'd do their bows, and they'd go, "Oh, Roshi, oh, my legs hurt." You know, and then, you know, they're talking to a chair. And some people found this very endearing, you know, people who trained with Soen Roshi, apparently many people really loved him, you know. But it would get tiring, wouldn't it, if it was every day, right? So you go into Dokusan and you suddenly realize you're talking to the chair with the ropes, you know, next time it's something else, you know, next time it's, you get old, right? If it was the same thing every time, it would, come in, there's the chair, there's the ropes, or she's hiding behind the, you know, the screen. You know, ah, yes, okay. You know. So every day, there's the Roshi, he's out going, "Come, Bodhisattva, here's your rice." You know. And there are complications to this koan also, besides the fact that it happens all the time. You know, when we visualize our ideal teacher, we probably visualize somebody like the Dalai Lama, right? In other words, you know, the Dalai Lama is a charming looking, first physically, he doesn't look threatening. He's a reasonably good looking person. He has good grooming habits, you know. He doesn't have much grooming to do, you know. Just a clean robe and take a bath, you know. But what if he didn't take a bath all the time? You know, what if the Dalai Lama came and you know, he gets off the plane and all the dignitaries go to meet him and it's like, whoa, you know. And in fact, you know, my second teacher, Kangan, went to Tibet quite often. And indeed, people in Tibet don't really bathe very much. I mean, that's an understatement, okay? Because it's at about 16,000 feet, and water is very scarce. So it is quite possible to go for years without a bath. And also, the Tibetans love rancid yak butter. Did you know that? It's like ghee, but it's rancid, and they like to have a real tang, you know, it has a good smell. So they use this for all kinds of things, including grooming, right? So, you know, basically, my teacher Webb really loved the Tibetans, but he used to say, he used to say, you can smell them before you see them. So, you know, the Dalai Lama arrives, he comes to Rutgers this fall. What if he came to Rutgers and the president is going to have a little reception? You know, we're going to have the event at the sports stadium. And in the box we normally reserve for millionaire sports fans, we're going to host a little gala event for the Dalai Lama. So, you know, trustees and business people are going to come to shake hands with the Dalai Lama, and the president wants to try to drum up some, you know, donations to Rutgers. And so what if the Dalai Lama comes and, you know, basically doesn't smell very good? Or what if the Dalai Lama comes and, you know, you go to hold out his hand and, you know, there's like some kind of, you go to take his hand and there's some kind of a sore on his hand. You know, and maybe it looks a little, you know, icky, you know. So, you know, then you might not, you know, be so happy to meet the Dalai Lama, you know. You know, this is a human nature, right? I mean, we form a mental image of the perfect teacher, and we have a mental image, and the perfect teacher is, something like the Dalai Lama. This is what we sort of keep in our minds as we move forward through our practice, you know. We want to be the perfect teacher, we want to study with the perfect teacher, and this is like powerful motivating force, you know. Teacher in this koan is not just a person. It's not just the person you happen to be practicing with. You know, teacher is anything. You know, everything can be our teacher. Kinyu Osho is this place, this building. Kinyu Osho is day four of Sesshin. See, Kinyu Osho is practice at where we sit at the Rutgers. You know, in other words, every day there he is with his pail saying, come on, bodhisattvas, here's your delicious rice. You know, and it's rice every day. This koan is really about a fundamental problem that we all have to confront, you know. Our expectations, this is sort of the theme of this session, you know, expectations are always a problem for us, for human beings. And so, a lot of Zen practice is trying to work with and against our expectations. You know, and this is not an accident. You know, the structure of Buddhism itself is both encourages and encourages expectations, and then, you know, basically causes a kind of crisis, and then you sort of go through reformulation, and, you know, so if you look at in the Tibetan tradition, for example, if you've ever seen one of the tankas, beautiful tankas, you know, they have highly stylized landscapes filled with bodhisattvas and buddhas. So, you know, basically up in the sky on the clouds, there are these happy buddhas, you know, and they might actually be, you know, waving their hands in the air, and they have big smiles, and they're floating on the clouds, you know, and down below are Buddha, lesser Buddha beings. It's all very beautiful and colorful. You look at these images of the Buddha, or images of Milarepa, or Tsongkhapa, or some of the other great teachers. Always beautiful, smiling images, you know. Buddhism encourages this a pursuit of perfection, and the representations of perfection are very powerful and enticing. You know? So hence, people come to Sesshin. And, you know, this is not really a fancy place. If it was really beautiful, if this building was really beautiful, many more people would come just because of the building. But the crisis they would face would be the same crisis, it usually happens just around day four of the Sesshin. It's interesting, actually it's the evening of day three. Perhaps you've noticed that one person is no longer here. And if you've been practicing with our group long enough, you know that this has happened. This doesn't happen in every Sesshin, but it happens quite often that somebody will come, maybe once a year, someone will come and basically disappear during the Sesshin. And, you know, if you're practicing and you're working on your koan, you probably aren't paying attention, and you really shouldn't be, but I'm paying attention. And I notice, you know, this person is gone. And it occurs to me, as I have practiced over the years, that it's almost always day three of Sesshin. And it's like I can predict, you know, because generally speaking, people who come to Sesshin have wonderful intentions. And, you know, when they leave, it's not a disgrace, it's not a betrayal, it's not the end of the world, you know, they can come back, you know, it's not as though, you know, they've let everybody down or let themselves, you know, this happens to people all the time. In fact, some of the people in this room have left Sesshin. In fact, left Sesshin on usually day three, you know. So it's, you know, it's a very human thing, you know, it's part of the process, actually, you know. But usually what happens is, somebody starts sending me a signal, even day one, you know, like, this is not what I thought it would be. Day two is, why shouldn't I leave, right? And usually I go, well, you know, why don't you stay, you know, give it a try, you know. Something wonderful can come, you know, don't... And day three is usually like, you know, I'm out of here. And the car... it's nothing personal. I mean, at least I don't take it personally. And I mean, because I've seen this at other places too. It's the expectation builds and builds as you practice more and more. And then, you know, you go through this process in Sesshin where, you know, it's like one by one, all your dreams are taken away from you, you know. People come to Sesshin and they think, oh, maybe this is the time I'll get Kensho or something. And you know, first day, you know, reasonably okay. Second day, you know, it's things are getting a little bit hair-raising, right? Because you're getting tired, you're running out of steam. You know, by day three, you know, if you can just, you know, who cares about enlightenment? I just want to, you know, get through the day, right? If I can just get through this damn day, you know. And this is really, really wonderful. It's just the most wonderful thing in the world because, you know, as we divest ourselves of all of these expectations and dreams, you know, we sort of have to encounter the moment. And we might not be ready for that. You know, it might just be, I'm not ready to come to this point, you know, hence the car driving away, you know. Years ago, a teacher came to our temple in Seattle and was a philosopher, very, well-known philosopher. And about halfway through the Sesshin, he left, and later Genki was talking to me, and he said that the man said to him, came into Dokusan and said, if I stay here one more minute, my whole philosophy will be in shambles, and will be completely destroyed. And so he left. But, you know, when that happens, you know, it's actually very energizing. It can be very energizing. It can be very wonderful. If your only concern is, being in the moment, surviving the moment, life takes on this extraordinary clarity and simplicity. And then I just love life at that level. At that level, life becomes just so wonderful. The great Chinese Zen master Xu Yun used to tell a story about the emperor, Puyi, last emperor of China. Xu Yun says that when Puyi would get up and, people would bring him his breakfast and his lunch and his dinner, and there were always many more dishes than he could possibly eat. So the kitchen, this huge kitchen, would prepare all these dishes for him, many of which he wouldn't even taste. He just looked, oh, not today. Caviar, he didn't eat caviar. Not today. That would be just plain food, but he would have something, all these special dishes, he would eat a little of this and a little of that, and, I don't know. It's just, I wanted something sweet and sour. This is too sweet and sour. If you have anything, with a hint of picante, hint of, hot. At one point, he was driven out of his palace, and he was under arrest, basically. And he had to flee. And everybody abandoned him, basically, except for a small group of people. And the only people who sort of gave him refuge were like farmers, simple farmers. And of course, they ate food like sweet potato shoots and sweet potato creepers. So in China, in the old days, sweet potato, if you plant a sweet potato, it grows these long creepers. And basically, this is often used as pig food, but poor people in China used to eat it at their dinner with their rice. And of course, the emperor had traveled for many days and had nothing to eat. Some peasants took him in and offered him safety. And of course, now he's just glad to be alive, right? It doesn't matter if he's wearing his silk brocades. It's just, thank God, I've got another few minutes of life, I'm happy, I'm grateful for just another few minutes, another day of being alive under the sky. What's for dinner? Sweet potato shoots. Oh, I haven't eaten in a week. This is so delicious. This is so delicious. And for a moment, Xu Yun said, for a moment, Puyi had a different life. It was really possible for him to live a different life, but then he, was rescued, rehabilitated, back to the palace, and that door was closed for him. But, when we simplify in this way, when we live from moment to moment, the day four, when we reach day four of Sesshin, there's this wonderful simplicity and this beautiful energy, just this simple energy of being alive. And you can say, well, we all have that, but it's not so. Not so. All of our lives we close ourselves off from the simple energy of being alive, I would say. And people feel chronically tired, lifeless, it's like, every day, there's the teacher, he's got his bucket of rice, it's always white rice, he always says, Bodhisattvas, come and get your rice. It's like, oh, again, there he is again, same damn rice, same damn teacher. This is, people live vitiated lives, you know, energyless lives, and they're constantly searching for novelty, you know, constantly searching for something new, you know, and this is like desperate, right? You know, you can go to Aruba once, you go to Aruba again, it's less special. Go to Aruba the third time, less special, you know, Aruba again, you know. So there's something wonderful, right, about being really hungry, about being really grateful for the next moment, you know. And this is possible on day four of sashimi. This is like, we've gone through this whole process of purification, and now people are really you know, doing wonderful work with your koans. You know, it takes a kind of encounter with this. It takes this stripping away, and then the encounter with the kind of desperation, maybe, or the, you know, all your pride is down the toilet. You know, all your, you know, I mean, basically, it has to be, right? You know, yeah, all your pride is down the toilet. You know, all your illusions are down the toilet. You know, basically, you're living with 20 other people, you know, and some of them snore, some of them fart, and some of them, you know, and you realize, you know, at some point, it doesn't matter. You know, I the interesting thing to me is that, you know, I form my deepest friendships have been Zen friendships. And, you know, I think it's that sharing that simplicity, you know. But, you know, I've formed enduring friendships with people, and, you know, my first encounter with them were wordless, just sitting there passing somebody rice. And you know, people I've known for 30 years, you know, or just cleaning floors together, or working in the kitchen together. It's a kind of a deep connection. It's really deeper than anything else, you know, because it's not encumbered by all of this baggage, you know. So day four is we're really at the moment when we can be possessed by life, and we have fewer reservations about it, you know. And that's really what Zen practice is all about. I mean, if you're doing Mu practice, you know, please, you know, Mu is not explained very well by teachers, I think. In fact, the Japanese style, traditionally, is not to tell you anything. It's just to say, you know, does a dog have Buddha nature? Mu. Good luck. See you in 10 years. Maybe you get it and maybe you don't. If you didn't get it, you were fated not to get it. You know. However, you know, it would be helpful to say to people, I think, actually, the art of the Mu Koan is not just sitting on the cushion going Mu, 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 Mu. That will get you nowhere. Mu is not a mantra. It has no magical power. You know, when you fix your mind on the word Mu or U or Wu, as you say your out-breath, there's no room for other thoughts to take root, or few thoughts can take root under those circumstances. So for just a second, your mind is very clear and thoughtless. And then at the end of the breath, eventually, if you look very carefully, when you look at your own mind, you'll see a blankness or darkness. See, this is the face of Buddha itself. Now, you know, when we look at that, we might say, well, big deal, you know. But that's only because, so to speak, our sense, we're so choosy. Our senses are so crude, are made so crude by our discriminating tastes and expectations that we can't really appreciate what this is. One, this is an amazing thing. So it's counterproductive just to sit on the cushion and call Mu. You want to be able to look Buddha in the face. So when you call Mu a couple times until your mind becomes relatively thoughtless, then look at Buddha, please. Okay, but, you know, if you look at Buddha, even that is not the whole story. You know, even that isn't going far enough. Because you can look at Buddha from afar, or you can become one with Buddha. See, there's a big difference. So this is the same thing for breath perception meditation. You can be so caught up in thoughts that you're unaware of your breath. Or with a little mental training, you can begin to be able to focus on the breath. But if you're just watching the breath as though at a distance, not much is achieved. What has to really happen is that you have to become one with your breath, unified with your breath. You know, there's a way of breathing out so that all self-consciousness disappears and you're going out with your breath. It's just like out, 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 out. Out, 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 out. So then the question is, where does the breath go? When it goes out, where does it go? Please don't trust your discriminating mind. Experience it. Where does it go? But the point is, my point is that it's not enough to see the breath. At some point you achieve, you return to your fundamental unity with the breath. And the way to do this is to squeeze with the dantian, the hara, and go out, out, out with the breath. Out, out, out with the breath. Everything disappears but breath. Then what happens? Well, it's the same thing with a little similar, not quite the same, but very similar with the move koan. As I said yesterday, it takes years of mental training, of practice, to be able to focus on move, just saying move. It takes years of mental training to be able to look into your mind and see the dark blankness. That takes many years of training. So don't, if you're doing that, even once or twice a day, that takes extraordinary mental training. If you're doing it with some regularity, that's wonderful. So then there's another stage, sort of stage three, which is allowing yourself to be possessed by mu. See? So, or to become one with mu. So we're calling mu, we're looking at the blank darkness, and then we're going to become one with mu. Now, how do we become one with mu? You can say, well, I see it, but how do I become one? I'm looking at it as though from a distance. The way to become one with mu is to allow mu to come through your body. Or another, to draw mu through your body. Another way to put it. See? So when people come into Dokusan and they are sitting, they're looking at Mu, and I say, please show me your Mu, or let me hear your Mu, it can seem rather artificial. You know, some people think this is all about making an impressive statement, like, you know, but it's really not about being loud or soft. It's about allowing mu to come through your body, or drawing mu through your body. So all the time that you're sitting on the cushion and you're calling mu, you should be looking at the blankness. And then if you see the blankness, what you want to do is to, when you're sitting there, you're on the cushion, you can't scream out loud, "Mu," well, please don't. But you can still be silently drawing mu through your body. So you're focused on the blankness, and you're drawing mu through your body. So, you know, you can say, well, I've been sitting here all day, move, 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 you know, drawing move through my body. But you know, every one of those is real encounter with Buddha, you know, every one. And if we do it long enough, you know, it becomes more and more natural, and we become more and more open. You know, the truth is that we have, whether we believe it or not, we have a lot of reservations about being possessed, even by mu. Right? It's a little bit strange, and that we're not maybe sure we totally trust the experience. Then when we do it, we might be disappointed with the results. So, you know, you might come into Dokusan, you focus on the blankness, you call mu, and it's like not much, you know, not much to write home about, you think, you know. So you come in. One time I actually screamed mu so much that I was hoarse, you know. And I went in to see the teacher, and as I tried to scream mu, my vocal cords sort of popped. And it was just like taking a run and slipping on a banana peel. It was just like nothing came out. It's like, and I couldn't call mu for a while after that. And actually had to call mu in some other way. So it's not about it's really about being open to the experience, right? Not a novel phrase, but you're going to be open to the experience, and if you have expectations, it just gets in the way, and a lot of Zen practice is just working through those expectations, you know, working past those. So, you know, if you come in and you call mu, I want you to know that every time you call mu, it's the voice of mu, you know. So at some point, this could either be very boring for you, or it could be very liberating, you know. I mean, actually, we really don't know how to deal with that kind of freedom, right? We really don't know how to deal with... You know, all of our lives we're trying to achieve something which is difficult and remote. And we're waiting to be acknowledged for being special. You know, and then if we don't get acknowledged, we feel wounded and worthless all of our lives. You know, but actually, Buddha nature is here all the time. You know, if you just let yourself be open to that energy, you know, it's really, really infinitely refreshing. You know, infinitely refreshing. You know, there's some things you do once or twice and you've done them. And there's some things you do and after a while you don't want to do them anymore. But there's some things you do and the more you do it, the better you feel. And if you keep practicing Zen, I swear to you, that's going to be how it is. You know, every time I get up in the morning to sit, I have a good time, you know. And that's why I get up. I wouldn't do it if I didn't, you know. You get up in the morning and you sit on the cushion, and each time I do it, I just feel wonderful. And I feel wonderful every time in a different way. And, you know, I really, I have had so many terrible sits, you know, that I don't have terrible sits anymore because I just realized there aren't any terrible sits. And that was all an illusion. So you have real freedom, you know, you have a real freedom in this practice. Well, every mu is perfect mu. Now maybe you're not ready yet to really, really experience this, you know. But please keep practicing. Please keep practicing. You know, one day you're going to be surprised. You know, I have been doing mu for, as I say, about 5 years, and I was, you know, at first I didn't know what I was doing for the longest time. Mu, 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 mu on the cushion and so on. And then I decided what the Roshi really wanted to see was like power, you know, like powerhouse. And so, you know, I would just go in and scream, you know. And I just thought, well, my moo is louder than anybody else's. You know, why aren't you passing me? And it was so contrived, as it has to be. See, I had such high, you go into the teacher, and my teacher's style was not to say every moo is good. My teacher used to say, if your moo can't knock over a person, don't even bother to show it to me. Right? That was his style. So it was a high standard, right? Mm-hmm. So of course, actually, nobody's moo can knock over a person. So it was like this unattainable high standard. So we were going, you know. And I just thought, you know, little by little, however, little by little, you know, I began to give up, and I went through the usual bitter period of disappointment. I'll never get anywhere. This is all a scam. This Zen is a scam. You know? I remember, this one session, you know, where I was very busy. I think I mentioned this earlier. I was very busy working on the windows, putting in windows. And it was so hot up there in the mountains, and we were working very hard. And, I didn't have a chance to think about what a poor, sad person I was, never answering my call on and so on. And I remember we were sleeping in tents, actually. Some of us slept in the Zen hall, but some of us slept in tents. And a thunderstorm came over in the morning, and then went away. We all got up and went in to sit, and we went about our business. We went in to sit, and it was in the morning. And I went to Dokusan in the morning, and I went into the kitchen. And, you know, literally what happened to me was not in my control. You know, I was so astonished when I called Mu, because it was like, holy smokes. You know, did that come out? Where did that come from? You know, where did that come from? It was absolutely amazing. And years later, a similar thing happened to me. I was sitting with another teacher, and I went to see this teacher, and he said, why don't we, I said, let's do some koans together. Like, I wanted to do like advanced koans. This was after I finished my training and everything, and I went to study with this teacher, and I said, let's do some koans. And I thought he was going to go, great. You know, I have some graduate school koans. for advanced students. Like, you know. So I said, great, you know, what have you got? He said, I want you to do Mu. And I felt like saying, well, I've already done Mu. You know, I've already done Mu. And so I said, fine. You know, I thought maybe he's testing me. You know. But the amazing thing was that, at this place, this is quite common in Rinzai temples. Every morning, people call Mu at the end of the recitation of sutras. I actually think this is quite artificial myself. But at this particular temple, everybody recites the sutras, and then the last sutra, you're supposed to end with a resounding moo, and everybody, you know, tries to give the powerhouse moo, and so on. But when I called moo, it was maybe day 4 or 5 of the session. What came out of my mouth was like this unearthly, I think it was like, where did that come from? You know, and this is Mu possessing, this is Mu moving through my body, Mu traveling through my body. You can't make it happen. And this is true for any koan. You're not going to make it happen. Just be present and just be present and do your best. And don't be daunted by failure. You know, it's so simple. You know, you call who 1,000 times and one time lightning strikes. And it's like, my, that was the voice of God. You know, that was amazing. Where, I know that did not come from me. Where did that, that's amazing. But you know, you have to try, if it's a hundredth time or the thousandth time, you have to try 1,000 times. And trying 1,000 times means at some point you start with high expectations, and then at some point your expectations are bitterly dashed, you know, by reality. And then you are, you're calling Mu, waiting for something to happen. And then one day, the most wonderful thing happens, you know, and it will happen. You know? And in fact, you know, it'll happen faster, it'll happen more readily if you, you try to realize, try to remind yourself that every one of these is Buddha, you know, the so-called failures and the so-called successes. You know, I've talked about this before, a lot of brain research now suggests that consciousness is really not the initiator of a lot of our actions. In other words, we think we choose to do something and then we do it. And a lot of research suggests that this is not so. That, you know, I've mentioned before that they've done experiments where they wire up somebody's head to see when the brain will send a signal to move the arm, let's say. And they'll say to somebody, when you choose to move your arm, press this button. So the person's got wires on his head, and the wires, indicate when the brain is signaling move the arm. And that when the person wills to move his arm, he presses the button. So the interesting thing is that the signal to move the arm happens before the person chooses to move his arm. I hope I'm making this clear. In other words, some part of the mind, some part of the brain chooses to move even before the person chooses to move. This is like spooky, right? Spooky. But this is how it really is, you know. Somebody, there's a bigger mind at work all the time. All the time. And the little mind is just nervously second-guessing all the time. Passing judgment, being disappointed, being angry, being fearful. And it's really silly, isn't it? You know, yesterday I said that if you are in a deep mushing and you look back on your life, you know, actually the whole thing seems absolutely perfect. And if you make the choices in your life that are consistent with your true nature, no matter how things turn out, when you look back on it, your life seems absolutely perfect. You know, and even your failures seem perfect. This is because it's like you thought you were creating your life a certain way, but life was creating you all the time. See, life is creating you. So, you know, really what you have to do is just let life carry you. You know, just let life carry you. You say, oh, it won't carry me, I'll fall. It's like, no, not so. You know, this is an element of trust. Life is carrying you anyway. You think you're making yourself go, but you're not. That's an illusion. It's been carrying you all along. It brought you here, for example. It brought you here. And it puts somebody else in a car speeding away, fast as a car would carry it. But you're here. So, you know, sitting on the cushion today, you know, call Mu with your whole being. Look at the darkness. Try to open yourself up to Mu. Let Mu move through your body. You know, every one of those moves is excellent. is the true, is a master's voice. When you come in to Dokusan, I want to hear the voice of Mu. Everyone is the voice of Mu. But you know, if you just keep doing it, one day you're going to be surprised. And if you do it this way, every time you do it, it's going to be better and better and better and better. You know. So, you know, one day, King Yu Osho comes out and in front of the kitchen, in front of the dining hall, and he says, come and have this delicious rice, my bodhisattvas. And they all laugh and say, what a great teacher. That's great. That's really funny. Next day, same thing. Next day, same thing. And begin to think, well, you know, this is kind of growing stale. This is kind of... But, you know, one day, every time he comes, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. And if you're not there yet, it will come. You know, it would be like every day is a miracle. Every day is absolutely wonderful. So, you know, how to start down that road? Don't listen to the little voice inside that says, I haven't answered my koan, I'm not getting anywhere with my practice. You know, people come into Dokusan and it's like they at some point I sometimes feel like they're trying to work the system. You know, it's like I'll say, that's close. How close? Is it close enough? Well, close is close, but it's not, you know. And it's what's the point? You know, what's the hurry? What's your hurry? You know, this is the Buddha itself. So anyway, everybody's doing a wonderful job. You know, we have one more day, and everybody's been practicing very diligently. It's taken you 4 days to reach this state, a very precious state where anything can happen. You know, probably many of you have had moments where you turn and the moment just seems perfect. Every moment can be like that. You know, just persist in your practice. Have no expectations, make no judgments, and the world becomes absolutely perfect. And so we have one more day. You can say, well, not much can be done today. Please don't listen to that voice. Anything can be done today. You know, just open yourself up. If your koan is breath, open to breath. If your koan is Mu, you know, look into blankness, call Mu, allow Mu to travel through your body, and let's see what happens. And if you have other koans, you know, hot water, cold water, be one with your koan.